The Laura Murphy Show, Episode 15.
Welcome to The Laura Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 15 of the Laura Murphy Show. We're glad you could join us. I am one of your hosts, Robert Murphy, economist at the Free Market Institute at Texas Tech University. And with me, as usual, is Carlos Lara. Carlos, how are you?
I'm very good, Bob.
Great. Carlos and I have gotten back from the Freedom Advisor event in St. Louis. We actually saw some of you, faithful listeners, showed up to that event, either actually attending or we had some people contact and just, you know, grabbing coffee on the side. Didn't want to pay the full freight, but hey, we're there. If you buy me a cup of coffee, I'll show up anywhere. So that was a great event. And what we're going to do in the next, I believe it's going to take us two episodes. We're going to start another series here. And what we're doing is we want to show you guys, by the time this thing is done, how it is that the federal government runs a budget deficit, right? So they spend more than they take in taxes, and then they ultimately pay for that through monetary inflation, right? So they get that money from the public, not through explicit taxation or even in the grand scheme by genuine borrowing of actual savings. But ultimately, in a certain sense, they do it by debasing the currency, by weakening the dollar. And so the public ends up paying for that government spending or that portion of it that's not covered by taxes through higher prices. All right. So, but it's a very complex mechanism. There's several things going on that you need to understand each of the pieces to then see how the whole thing comes together. And so the way I've seen Carlos explain this in a public presentation is, and this was the first time I saw him live in front of a crowd, he first walked through how Caesar would run his finances. And so I'm going to turn it over to Carlos, but let me just preface this with two things. First, if you like what you hear in this episode and then the next one, by all means, I encourage you to go get a copy of our book, How Privatized Banking Really Works, because there we spell it out in much greater detail and with a lot more numbers and so on. You can really see exactly what's going on at your own pace. But also, number two, in the interest of brevity and just to sort of make the story compelling and to focus on the economics of it, which is really what the issue is here, Carlos is not going to give specific historical dates and say, and then on this date this happened. He's going to be giving sort of a story involving Caesar. So grant us some leeway here. This is not a historical speech that Carlos is going to give. He's trying to get you to see how inflation and debasement of the currency works to let the sovereign spend more than he dare tax from the public. And he's going to use the historical example of Caesar to make the point. So with those caveats, let me turn it over to Carlos.
Okay, well, I think the best way to try to get into this story and this discussion, as Bob's already said, it can get kind of technical, so we need to kind of keep it light on the front end. I would say that we need to focus on that word inflation. I'll be honest with you. I had a completely different understanding of inflation, as I know many people do. And the reason for it is because we were all educated in Keynesian schools, I mean, because those are the kind of schools that we have. And so typically, when the word inflation is used, we're talking about the, you know, price inflation, the increase in prices, or another way to say is the rising cost of living. And I guess it was Henry Hazlitt, one of the great Austrians, who opened my eyes to this word inflation when he basically was saying, if you just look at inflation as the rise in prices, what that's really doing is deflecting attention away from the real cause of inflation, which he spelled out and said was the increase of the money supply. You know, the fact that the volume of money is inflated or blown up or overextended in the economy. So if you too can grasp that idea to begin with and begin to try to understand that inflation is more the increase of the money supply, it may do the same thing that it did to me. It began to open my eyes to this whole problem of money in our economy.
So let me just stop you right there for a second, Carlos, just to make sure people aren't missing the big picture. So he's hitting on a very important point that Ludwig von Mises made and that Henry Hazlitt following up made, and that now we've taken to making sure audiences understand and our readers, is that historically, when economists talked about inflation, they meant inflation of the money supply, or sometimes they might mean the supply of money and credit. Whereas nowadays, of course, people say inflation with no context. What they mean is prices keep going up. Oh, gee, things keep getting more expensive. And so Mises would argue that that's mistaking now the symptoms for the cause. And it as Carlos said, it detracts attention away from the culprit. If really it's the central bank pumping in more dollars that's making the dollar less and less valuable, then if we're just looking at rising prices quoted in dollars and saying, oh, why is things so more expensive? Is it because of these greedy companies, or is it because of labor unions, or is it because the Arabs are embargoing us and that's why oil's going up? So that we're looking around at everybody else and we're not looking at the true culprit, which is the entity that is responsible for creating more dollars.
Right. And even John Maynard Keynes, Bob, stated that one man in a million could understand or grasp the process of inflation and how it actually works within our economy. Another famous individual that I think most of us are familiar is the quote from John Adams, in which he said that all of the perplexities and confusion and distress in America arises from the downright ignorance of the nature of coin, credit, and circulation. So in that quote, he's pointing to the three essentials that are involved with inflation. One is money. When he says coin, that's money. Credit, obviously credit's involved, and how it circulates in our economy. And he's right when he says that it causes a great deal of confusion and distress and in people. And he said that back in 1829. And so inflation has been plaguing the human race for a very long time. And it's because every time it's, mysteriously, put into motion, it does create distress among the people. So if we traveled 500 years back in time, if we traveled 1,000 years back in time, even 2,000 years, we see the evidence of the very same thing. And every time we see inflation, we see the tremendous destruction that it creates. Now, here's where we want to talk about Caesar for just a moment. And you probably will need to use a little bit of your imagination, if you will, and picture the great Roman Empire. So in your mind's eye, if you can picture the powerful Caesar sitting at its throne and overlooking a sea of tens of thousands of heavily armed Roman soldiers, and all of them equipped with the finest weaponry that money can buy. And you can, if you're looking out over the sea of that many soldiers, you begin to feel the power of Rome the pomp of Rome, the ceremony surrounding Rome. And it creates a very powerful imagery. And if you will then take and consider for just a moment just the cost to outfit such a powerful military force, you know, all to feed all those horses, to feed all those men, to clothe them, the cost, I'm sure, was astronomical. And now think of Rome itself, you know, just the splendor of Rome, you know, all the lavish architectures, the water systems, irrigation systems, the great Colosseums. You know, we've all seen pictures of Rome, and it was breathtaking to look at. But consider the cost to maintain all of that. You know, how in the world did Caesar pay for all of that? And of course, the answer is in Caesar's powerful army. The Roman Empire actually stole much of its wealth when they would conquer other territories. They would, you know, bring all the wealth back into Rome, all the gold, all the treasure. But in addition to that, they also collected tribute or a tax. And they would collect this not only from the victims of the war, the territories that they had conquered, but they also collected this very same tax from its own citizens. And it was a heavy tax. most of it was pulled in by force. People were not really anxious to pay it. But Caesar never had enough money, you know, to cover all of those expenditures. You know, not only did he have an insatiable appetite, but literally no amount of money would ever satisfy. So if you can imagine that typically at the end of each year's tax collection, and after all the plunder, you know, had come into, you know, into the treasury there, what Caesar would realize is that he still had a heck of a lot more expenditures than gold. And so what is Caesar to do when you've got all these bills to pay and you don't have enough money to pay it with? Now, he knows better than to come back and tax the people more. Yeah, and he knows that because if you tax people too much, I mean, they will revolt on you. So, what does Caesar do? Well, he comes up with a clever scheme. And what he does is that he orders his ministers of the treasury there to take all the gold coins, and he wants them to clip all of the edges of the gold coins. You know, just clip the edges around the coins now so that he can melt down all of those clippings and make more gold coins. So in taking that action, what we are seeing that Caesar is secretly tampering with the value of the money, right? Because he's lowering its value by doing that. The coins he clips are smaller. The whole coin weighs less. Okay, so he's reducing the weight of each gold coin.
So let me just stop you for a second, Carlos. So remember, folks, we're hearkening back to a time when the money really was weights of precious metals. It wasn't just a token that represented something else. This really was that people thought they had a coin that was a certain weight of gold, let's say. And so Carlos is saying that one technique originally that the sovereign could take, the political ruler could take, was to shave off around the circumference of the coins some of the actual metal so they would get a bunch of, you know, clippings of the actual gold, let's say, and then they could take that and melt it down and make new coins if they wanted. And so the original coin that was still stamped with whatever the official markings were. And so the average person might not notice that actually, you know, some little bit of the gold had been shaved off from around the edges in order that the sovereign could then, you know, use more of it, right? So that wouldn't really work with dollar bills today. Like if you just took a scissors and cut off a tiny little, you know, few millimeters from each end of a dollar bill, you couldn't then stitch them all together and have more dollar bills at your disposal because it wouldn't look correct, right? That's because, you know, it's paper with a certain image on it, whereas back then the money was a physical amount of gold. And so that's why if you shaved off a little bit from each of the coins, then you'd have a big pile of shavings. You could melt them down and make new coins. That's partly why gold and silver historically were the market's monies of choice, precisely because they had that feature that they were homogeneous and easily malleable. And so you could take a bunch of coins and melt them down and then create other things and so on, whereas diamonds or rubies didn't have that property. If you cut a diamond in half, you can't just put it back together. But if you take a gold bar and break it in half, you can, you know, if you have enough heat and whatever, put it back together. So that's the story that Carlos is talking about at this point, that if you had pre-existing gold coins in circulation that had stamps on them to let the public know how much weight of gold there was in this coin, and you were duplicitous, you could shave a little bit off the edges, and the average person handling it in day-to-day commerce might not notice the difference.
Yeah, and you think about it, Bob, this is a very clever scheme. Because again, you know, he has he's reduced the weight of each gold coin for one. But then in addition to that, notice that what he has done is that he's increased the money supply, you know, measured in terms of the coins, because he has created additional coins from the clippings. And of course, when you think about it, he's going to be the very first one to benefit from this increase in coins. Now, at this point, you're listening to the story, and I'm sure you're thinking it's got to be some sort of a fairy tale, but it really isn't. I mean, this story is actually true. I'm telling it as a story, but it is a historical fact of what actually happened. So we do need to continue on with the story, even though it may sound like a fairy tale, so it's probably helpful for me to tell you, this is a true story, in order to see how this scheme is applicable, you know, to our own economy in 2016. Okay, so let's go on with it. So now Caesar, with these additional coins, is able to pay for all the required expenditures, you know, with this increase of the money supply. And maybe he's bought a few other luxuries for himself. So all the people, the soldiers and whatnot, that have been waiting to be paid are now paid. And, of course, all of this extra money now starts to flow out into the Roman economy. Now, let's say that you are a Roman merchant in the marketplace, and you sell fresh fish at a price of one gold coin for one fresh fish. So here comes a Roman centurion who's just been paid by Caesar with one of these new coins. And he makes a purchase, you know, at your fish market. And he pays you one gold coin for one fish. But now the merchant, you know, starts to handle that new coin, and he looks at it a little bit closer, and he's examining it, and he realizes something different about that coin. So he reaches into his own pocket and pulls out one of the original old coins, and he compares it to this new coin. And yes, he was right. There is a difference. So you can pretty much see what's going to happen for that transaction to continue. You know, obviously, the merchant is quickly going to demand two gold coins for the fish instead of the one. So, and it's only right, and it's only fair that he do that, since these new coins have a lower gold content. Now, if you could see that transaction and see how the same type of transaction is going to be repeated countless of times throughout the entire Roman economy with this new money that's been put out there. And each time those transactions occur, prices are going to increase on everything. And it all started because of Caesar's, you know, originally counterfeiting that caused the increase both in the prices and the supply of money. So see, that's the main point to understand here.
Let me jump in, Carlos, again, just to reiterate what you've been saying to make sure everyone's getting it. So again, we're back in a world where what the actual money was a weight of the precious metals. And so the function of having coins that were stamped and had a particular shape and so forth on them was just a signal to the community that, oh, this is authentic. This really is, you know, what one, whatever the weight was, unit of weight they used, amount of gold, let's say. And so Carlos's point is, if originally there was goods in the marketplace that would sell for one gold coin, and now the market gets flooded with new coins that are still stamped, the one official gold coin, but people, the merchants realize, wait a minute, you know, at the end of the week, they go and look over at their chest of coins they've collected, and they realize that these new coins that are being circulated and that the soldiers have in their pockets and, you know, the people the soldiers spend the money on and so forth, they realize that, no, actually, this doesn't have as much gold in it as the coins used to. And so these new coins that people are spending actually don't have the full weight of gold. And so the official price, if we're all still going to be quoting things in terms of the coins now, is going to have to go up. It's not really that fish have become scarcer. It's not like it's harder to go catch a certain amount of fish and bring them to market. It's that the currency, you know, a unit, a one coin no longer has the same gold content as it used to have. And so that's the issue.
Yeah. Now, the unfortunate thing is that the story doesn't end here, because actually the following year, guess what? Caesar is faced with the same problem again. He's collected all the tribute from his citizens and everywhere else. He's brought in all the loot, but it's still not enough. There's not enough gold to pay for everything. So what Caesar starts to do is to pull off the same clipping of the coins trick, okay? He's going to do it again because he doesn't have enough money. But he notices something kind of strange. The gold coins all have notches or ridges carved into them all around the edges. So what's going on here? The people have gotten wise to his trick. So they deliberately have put a mark on the money all around the edges so that any newly clipped coins, you know, could easily be spotted. Now, just as a matter of historical information, these notches are the rings around the edges of coins, or it's known as reading. And, you know, symbolically, that's what we have with our own coins, is reading, but it refers back to this protection of coin clipping, you see. But anyway, not able to clip the coins again because the public has discovered what Caesar has done. So he comes up with another idea. And so this time, Caesar orders that all of the gold that they have in their possession, all of it, be melted down, and then that a base metal needs to be mixed in with it. So this is now going to increase the mixture volume, and Caesar is now able to create even more gold coins. So once again, you know, this is another form of debasing the money in order to create more of it.
Let me, if you permit me, Carlos, again, make sure we're not losing anybody, jump in. So this is really where the term debasement, I believe, historically comes from. Is so, making up numbers, let's say Caesar starts out with 1,000 gold coins, you know, coins that have the actual gold content that you need for a sturdy coin. He then melts them all down, adds in some baser metal, you know, something that's not gold, but some other metal that, you know, is a good for, you know, holding the shape and sturdiness of a coin. And so now he's got more liquid, you know, of a higher volume of liquid at his disposal than he did when he first melted the stuff down, because he just added some to it. And now maybe he then remints the coins, and maybe now he's got 10% more coins than he did originally because he added in that baser metal. And so the point is, on average, each of these new coins is going to have only 90% of the original gold content and now 10% of the, you know, the new baser metal added to it. So there he has literally debased the currency. The currency now is not just the solid gold content, but is also consisting of a baser metal that's been added to it. But now he's got, if people don't realize that originally, and they think the gold coins he's coming to the market with have the same gold content as they did originally, for a while at least, the merchants are going to go ahead and sell Caesar's soldiers and whoever else gets access to those coins early on, sell them stuff at the old prices until they become wise to what's happened. And so then, of course, Carlos, what happens at that point?
Well, you know, basically, again, the same thing happens in that, you know, prices begin to rise on everything just like before. And this counterfeiting practice was continually used by Caesar for many, many years, until really the Roman coin contained less than 1% of its true precious metal. And the end result was that eventually the Roman money became totally worthless. So the entire monetary system collapsed. Now, at some point, the government tried to stop it from collapsing by, you know, putting price controls on that, but without the merchants being able to increase the prices on their products, there was no way that they could keep their operations going in selling goods. So they went out of business. So the population, you know, can no longer obtain the necessities of life, and so they wind up basically fleeing to the country and countryside, and, you know, trying to live off the land again. And so all these disruptions that came into Rome is what really made them vulnerable, you know, to foreign invaders who, when they had the powerful armies and everything, they could actually, you know, push these invaders away. But Rome really fell to conquering, you know, barbarians simply because the whole monetary system had collapsed, and debasing it is what brought it down in the final analysis.
Yeah, and here Carlos is echoing the historical analysis of Ludwig von Mises, that Mises gives this explanation in Human Action and probably other places too that I'm forgetting at the moment. But Mises argued that, look, it's too simplistic to just say, oh, the reason Rome fell was because of the barbarian invasions, because that barbarians had been at the gates before, you know, trying to come in, and the Roman armies always beat them back easily. So why was it, you know, that at this time when Rome fell, what was different? And Mises argued that, well, among other things, it was the fact that there had been this monetary inflation coupled with draconian price controls. And that, as Carlos was mentioning, what happens in that situation? Well, if merchants are not being paid enough in the cities, you know, if they're not allowed to raise their prices to cover the costs of what it now costs them to import things from outside the city, food and whatnot, they're just going to stop selling things. And so the shelves are emptied and disappeared. And that's exactly what we see going on in South America. You know, Venezuela is a basket case right now, for example. And so you saw the same pattern in Rome, and Mises was saying, so a lot of people, they fled the cities because they were starving, and they went out into the open countryside just to forage and do what they could to survive. And so he said for a lot of Romans, they welcomed the conquering invaders because their life was so miserable under the existing regime. Mises says that's, you can't understand Roman history without seeing what to some people might seem like, oh, just a mere economic issue, regard, you know, that has nothing really to do with cultural or social or political or military concerns. But as you can imagine, Mises, an economist, thinks that actually economics has a lot to do with the course of nations. So, I'm sure some historians would dispute that, but I'm just explaining that what Carlos is relying on there is the Misesian explanation for the fall of Rome. So if I give a big picture of what we've covered in this episode, number one, the distinction between monetary inflation versus price inflation, and that it's the increase in the quantity of money that ultimately leads to the increase in prices, and that's why it's probably more useful to think of inflation as increasing the money supply, because that's the cause, whereas rising prices are merely the effect or the symptom. And then number two, Carlos walked you through historically, it was really obvious to see what happens when the sovereign wants to spend more than he can take in taxes, because he doesn't want there to be a revolt. And so what does he do? He literally debases the currency. He takes the coins he gets through taxation and other forms of tribute. He melts them down, adds in a base metal, something that's not as valuable as gold, so he can then remint a greater number of coins, and he goes into the marketplace and spends those things. But eventually the merchants realize these coins that are now in circulation have less gold content than before, so the prices quoted in those coins go up to reflect the fact that each coin now has less gold than it did. And so the public now is still ultimately shouldering the burden of Caesar's spending, but they're not merely doing it through explicit taxation. They're also partially shouldering the burden of the fact that it's more expensive to go buy fish now than it used to be. And so if your income in gold coin, or sorry, in coins hasn't gone up commensurately, then you lose out. That things get more expensive even though your income doesn't rise up initially to meet it. And so you're going to the marketplace with the same coins you had before, but now things are more expensive because of what Caesar's done. So that's just, it's pretty easy to see in that environment. And then next time we're going to show you how that same intuition plays out in today's context. But as you can imagine, there's a lot more smoke and mirrors involved. Carlos, do you have any closing thoughts for our faithful listeners?
Only to say that it's true, Bob, that all governments have done this in one way or another throughout history. It's amazing. If you go back and see it and study it, you see that this is what they do. I think it's inherent in the nature of government to do this, not only to control the supply of money, but to tamper with it, mostly for its benefit first. So it really is a legalized assault on private property.
Yeah, and that's why, among other reasons, we're such big proponents of privatizing money and banking, returning those essential institutions back to the private sector, that you wouldn't trust the government to make cars or make computers. So why in the world would you entrust the government with controlling the money? That's just ludicrous to me. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode. You've been listening to The Laura Murphy Show. I encourage you, if you haven't already done so, to go to our website and check out all the information. You know, it's funny, we still get comments from people emailing us and saying, hey, I love the podcast, but where do I go to learn more? Well, go to the place that hosts the podcast. That's lauramurphy.com. It's spelled LARA-MURPHY.com, where you'll see all the information you need to get up to speed on both Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Whether you're an average person in a household, a business owner, or a financial professional, we have specially designed tracks of posts to take you in to varying depths of how deep you want to go with these concepts and learn to your heart's desire. So with that, we will sign off. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next time.
You've just finished another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Laura Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of lauramurphy.com are not herein engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.